My name is Matthew Bardowell. I'll be offering a little message today. And I'm so grateful to be here with all of you gathered in this room, but also all of you online, which includes my parents, by the way, from Florida. They go to their church every Sunday. Oh, that's nice, yeah. And then they watch this service. So I think that says a lot about how special this group is, that they've been here a few times and they've met you and they feel a part of things here. So hi, Mom and Dad. They're going to really like that when they watch that later. Today's sermon is going to be a continuation of some messages on The Chosen, clips from The Chosen. Is that really in the Bible? And today's message is faith when life is murky. So we have one clip to watch now. So please direct your attention up there. Moment in which Jesus enters Jerusalem. The specific manner in which Jesus does this is significant. Those observing the scene seem to be aware that they are watching Old Testament prophecies about the Messiah being fulfilled before their very eyes. In this moment, Jesus looks every bit a king ushering in his kingdom. And that's exactly what he is. But if the disciples are aware that prophecies are being fulfilled, there are still many things that they are not aware of. They know the kingdom of heaven is near, but they drastically misunderstand the nature of that kingdom. In this moment, as depicted by the producers of The Chosen, they aren't feeling any doubt, no uncertainty. In this moment, Jesus is the culmination of all their wildest hopes. Think of the smiles, the joy, the elation they must have been feeling. They are clearly exalted, having a religious experience. Have you ever had a moment like that? Have you ever felt so certain, so exalted by the thought of the Savior, the Lord, the Prince of Peace, the Messiah, God made flesh, that the feelings of confidence in your faith grew and grew until all other thoughts were crowded out? How could there be room in our brains for anything else, for any thought, any desire alongside a revelation like that? Maybe you've had that feeling while singing together in worship. Maybe it was during a sermon, but probably not. Maybe it was a quiet moment where a thought proposed itself to you and you were awed by it. Maybe it was during a movie or time with loved ones. Who can enumerate all the ways the Holy Spirit reaches out to us in our humanity to give us this moment of overwhelming faith? I hope you've had many moments like that. But even if you have, there is no denying that they are often brief. Would it be right to call them fleeting? It might be appropriate to call them temporary, but only if we understand the truth that we're realizing to be the constant, blinding, and blistering reality of the universe we inhabit, but only overlapping with our awareness in flashes. After all, it's not long after the moment we all just watched that Jesus gives his disciples a very different religious experience. Let's watch that now.
In a little while, you will not see me. And then after a little while, you will see me. Truly, truly I say to you, you will weep and lament. But the world will rejoice. You will be sorrowful. But your sorrow will turn into joy.
Faith can be like that too. Sometimes faith can feel so much like doubt that it's hard to tell the two apart. These scenes, positioned one right after the other, highlight this conflict. How can we in one moment feel so sure and then in another moment so unsure? And if we move between certainty and doubt like this, can we really call ourselves faithful? The words Jesus speaks in the Last Supper scene are taken directly from the Gospel of John, chapter 16, verse 16. In a little while, you will see me no more. Then after a little while, you will see me. This is confusing. What does Jesus mean by see me no more? That's a troubling statement. I thought he was just entering into his kingdom. I thought this was a beginning, not an end. And then, what does Jesus mean by a little while? How long is a little while? This reminds me of a miscommunication about time that happens often in our house. Rachel and I might say something like, after dinner, we will go get ice cream. Now, Rachel and I think that when we say after dinner, we mean sometime after dinner. We think it means today, but it could be any time after we eat and before we go to bed. All that time is after dinner. But the kids think after dinner means the nanosecond after we chew the last bite of dinner, immediately after dinner. You can imagine the problems this causes. I won't bore you with the details. Who is correct? Is immediately after dinner considered after dinner? Sure. Is after we wash the dishes and use the restroom also after dinner? I think so. It can be so easy for us on this side of the gospel story to identify more with Jesus here than the disciples. We know what he means. The disciples would soon find out. We have information that they don't. And so we can delude ourselves into thinking that we always have the insight we need in every moment to feel the fervent faith of the triumphal entry. But it can be very hard to have a humble awareness of the things you don't know. The title of today's lesson is Faith When Life is Murky. But I have to wonder if we truly understand just how murky it can be. There are some of us here this morning who perceive that murkiness more intensely than others. There are others here this morning who feel triumphant more than others. But what if these two experiences aren't faith and doubt, or doubt and faith? What if they are two points along a journey of faith that we are all on in our own unique ways? This question led me to consider someone who predates the gospel account we've looked at today, but who nonetheless is in the background of any discussion about faith, Abraham. Father Abraham, the father of faith. I think specifically about God calling him to sacrifice his son, Isaac. What must Abraham's experience of faith have been like? We have to make sure we understand the background here. Abraham is 75 years old when God first promises him a son. He is 100 when Isaac is born, which means Abraham waits 25 years to see God's promise fulfilled. In that time, Abraham does seem to experience doubt. Remember Hagar and Ishmael? But through it all the ups and downs, God is faithful in his timing, and he blesses Abraham with the child he promised, Isaac. Abraham must have experienced great joy upon the fulfillment of that promise, don't you think? Abraham will be the father of a great nation. His descendants, like the sand on the seashore or the stars in the sky, will be too numerous to count, and they will come through Isaac. Then, several years after Isaac is born, God asks Abraham to offer Isaac as a sacrifice. What do you think must have gone through Abraham's mind? God promised him that he would have a son, and he did. Now God asks him to give up that son. Here's one possible way of framing Abraham's experience. Abraham was joyful for a while, but that joy eventually turns to sorrow. Yes, God did say he would have descendants through Isaac, but maybe that was wrong. Maybe the great nation that will issue from Abraham will come through another child Sarah will bear. But wait, didn't they already try that with Ishmael? Didn't God specifically say not just that Abraham would have numerous descendants, but they would come through Isaac? How can this nation be born through Isaac if Isaac is dead? That seems pretty murky, pretty confusing. Abraham seems to be in a bind. How can he believe God without doubting him? He seems to have no choice but to doubt either that his descendants will come through Isaac or to doubt that God really wants him to sacrifice Isaac. Like I said, that's one way to frame the story. But there's another way. To understand that way, I want to tell you briefly about a philosopher named Soren Kierkegaard. He wrote a book called Fear and Trembling under the pen name Johannes de Silentio. And this book centers on the topic of faith in the story of Abraham. He asked the question, what makes Abraham the father of faith? To help his readers think through what faith means to Abraham, he spins some alternate scenarios. Here's some hypotheticals he considers. What if Abraham, when Isaac asks why they are ascending the mountain, had said, I have decided to kill you because of my own wickedness? Well, Kierkegaard reasons, if he had said this, it would have been because Abraham would have preferred for Isaac to think he were a monster rather than risk Isaac's faith in God during his final moments. But if he had done that, Abraham would not be the father of faith. Here's another scenario Kierkegaard considers. What if, when God calls Abraham to sacrifice his son, Abraham thinks, I have perhaps loved my son with an idolatrous love. And now God is demanding that I throw down my idol and offer him up on the altar. But if he had thought that, he would not have been the father of faith. In yet another scenario, Kierkegaard imagines Abraham hearing God's call to offer his son and thinking that perhaps God had changed his mind about his initial promise. Maybe God simply... But what if he had thought that? He would not have been known as the father of faith. So what does Abraham think? Well, we don't have to wonder, because the author of Hebrews tells us. In Hebrews 11:17, it reads, by faith, Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. He who had embraced the promises was about to sacrifice his one and only son, even though God had said to him, it is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned. Abraham reasoned that God could even raise the dead. And so in a manner of speaking, he did receive Isaac back from the dead. So what does this mean? It means that Abraham believes the absurd. He believes both that God wanted him to have his son and that God wanted him to sacrifice his son. How can he believe these two contradictory things? Well, for Abraham, these two things aren't a contradiction. Abraham reasoned that God could even raise the dead, and so in a manner of speaking, he did receive Isaac back from the dead. This is what makes Abraham the father of faith. It's Kierkegaard who argues that Abraham believed the absurd. But I suppose we could interpret the absurd here to mean the impossible. But for God, the impossible is only impossible until it's not. For God, all things are possible. So how does God communicate this sort of faith to human beings like us? So often he seems to reach for figurative language. In that earlier passage from John, Jesus later admits that he speaks to the disciples in figures of speech, because the truth can be hard to understand when our minds and our experiences are so limited. Even the author of Hebrews says that Abraham, in a manner of speaking, that is, figuratively, receives Isaac back from the dead. Figurative language is really good at using things we already know to describe things we do not know yet. So what does Abraham's faith have to say to the disciples in the Last Supper? And what does it say to us now? There are a few things to note here. First, it's simply impossible for the disciples to know what they don't know yet. What Jesus needs to communicate hasn't happened yet, and they cannot foresee it. They need to learn in their own way, in their own time, and that time is not yet here, but will come in a little while. They just have to hang on until it gets there. Consider this. There are many laws of nature. Gravity, the sun rises in the east, sets in the west. Objects in motion remain in motion until a force acts upon them, etc., etc., right? These laws are as eternal as the foundations of the earth. They've been true for an incredibly long time. But every single person on this earth who has been born was not born knowing them. They have to be learned for the first time. So for every single person who's ever lived, they've learned about those truths for the first time in their own experience. Someone else knowing about gravity does nothing to make you know about gravity. Even if we're taught about it, we still have to do the learning. This is what Kierkegaard seems to say about faith as well. How could Abraham explain to someone else why he's taking Isaac to the top of Mount Moriah? How could he explain that his plan was to kill him upon an altar? How could he have told someone his belief that God would raise Isaac from the dead? How could he have known that an angel would stop his knife? And even if he could have explained all those things, how could he have made anyone else believe them? Here's another paradox for you. Abraham's realization of faith was unique to him, but the faith itself is eternal. It is real, and it has existed in countless people since the very beginning of time. The flame of faith that burned in Abraham's soul is the same faith that burns in the disciples' souls as they walk with Jesus into Jerusalem, and it's the same faith through which they ponder his words at the Last Supper, and it's the same faith in our souls today as we make up the church. Faith when life is murky is a gift from God. And as we gather here today, that fire of faith is in each one of us, and it's flickered into life in so many different ways. Each of us will face different challenges, different tests of faith. The way we walk through those moments will be unique to us. So deeply meaningful, but also hard to explain to anyone else. At the Last Supper, the disciples don't seem to know what to make of Jesus telling them that they will not see him. But in John 14, Jesus offers them this comfort, even though they can't understand it yet. Do not let your hearts be troubled. You believe in God. Believe also in me. My Father's house has many rooms. If that were not so, would I have told you that I am going there to prepare a place for you? And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, so that you may be where I am. Let's all reflect on our faith and what it's meant for us individually this week.